Sorry for the interruption.
Yeah, Dave Bernard's our first presenter. Dr. Bernard worked for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and Chinook Salmon Research for many years. Since retiring from the department, he remains involved with the Pacific Salmon Commission and with scientific issues surrounding the Endangered Species Act. Dave's presentation is entitled Understanding Productivity of Chinook Salmon, Comments on the Accuracy and Precision of Scientific Information. Here you go, Dave.
Thanks, Bob, and thank you for all being here. I appreciate the chance to stand up here and talk to you about all the mistakes I've made over the last 30 years, because basically that's what I'm going to be talking about. Provided, of course, I can get my... Doesn't help, but I have a headlight in my face.
There you go, you got it.
There we go. I've worked for the department for about 25 years in the capacity of dealing with the information that the department uses to manage fisheries. And as such, I can assure you that the department spends quite a bit of time and effort in trying to make its data of the best quality. And I believe I'm going to expand upon an item that John Lindman brought up this morning, and that is one of data accuracy and precision. However, we'll start with the fundamentals about, you know, the data used to essentially to do productivity analysis. This morning you heard something about a Ricker model or a Beverden-Hope model. Well, basically, we put our investigations of productivity, whether they be to answer questions or to set escapement goals, in the context of a model. And in this particular model, it's very simple. You have S. Okay. Where, Bob, do you have the laser pointer?
Yeah.
Ah, okay. Oh, my. All right, let's go back this way. Okay. The model is very simple. It has an input spawning escapement. That's the S for each brood year. And as an output, it has production. Now, the model also has other terms in it. The process error that you see here, that corresponds to the natural variation that you see in production given an escapement. Now, the lieutenant governor came in this morning and talked about his experience in Prince William Sound, where every year they released the same number of pink salmon, but they got radically different returns. That difference from expectation to reality is that natural variation. And this model is then comprised of parameters. The one that's of most importance to us in our discussion is the alpha parameter, which is the productivity parameter. And we're going to try and to estimate that in terms of a productivity investigation. Now, what we do is we have two time series of data. We talked about that at length this morning. One for production and one for escapement. Now, basically, we don't really know in most cases what production is or what escapement is. We estimate them, and then we use the estimates in this analysis. And by and large, we regress one against the other, and we come up with an estimate for the productivity parameter. Well, this is very simple, and it can provide a necessary understanding relative to doing something like setting an escapement goal. In this model, the cause and effect relationship is obvious. Spawners in, production out. And by and large, it works. But it has problems. And these problems stem from the way we have to look at the world. Productivity in fish populations is a population-level phenomenon. Because of that, we can't do experimentation. So what we have to do is observe. And we have to observe what's out there. We can't observe what isn't. Now, because of this, we have certain sources of, we'll call them error. That's a statistical term. That can cause problems. One is model error. We talked about that a little this morning. Ricker, Bevernant, Holt, something else. And as Dr. Catalano showed you, it can be real difficult in understanding or getting from the data just which model is the better or the best. Now, the second source of problems is process error. That's that natural variation. And if you ignore that, particularly as it relates to a time series, you can end up with a biased estimate or an inaccurate estimate of productivity. We are assuming that as time goes by, each deviation, each year is independent of the others, each brood year. And that's not necessarily the case. Observational error. Now, this is a little different than what Dr. Catalano talked about, because observational error in this context is that you have to deal with the hand that you're dealt. The data set you have is a result of many things. We talked about the shortness and the brevity of it. That's observational error. You don't have enough data to really reveal the process underneath. And then there's always one problem, and that is we're assuming that the past is prologue to the future. And it may not be. And in fact, you may end up having something like, you know, a black swan. Now, a little more about the black swans when we end this particular presentation. But what a black swan is, it's something that's just totally unexpected. The last source of error, measurement error, comes from us having to estimate production and escapement through sampling. And this is important because this adds uncertainty, particularly the estimates of escapement. If you ignore it, you're running into a difficulty or a potential problem of biasing your estimates of productivity one way or the other. One last thing I'd like to say about observational error is that you could have a situation in which you have 30 years of data, but really only have one point for information. And Alaska's management program is prone to that particular kind of observational error. If you were to manage for an escapement, and your manager, like most of ours, are perfect, and they hit that number or near that number year after year after year, do you have 30 years of information? No, not really. What you have is a lot of detailed information on what one escapement is going to give you. So that also is observational error. In short, the information that we have is always equal to or most likely less than the data that we have. Now, fortunately, there are some analytical solutions for some of these problems. If you have time series problems with your model, we know how to add parameters and functions to account for that error. You saw that in some of the modeling this morning. Observational error. You can't do a lot about observational error except in some cases where you can bring in a priori information from other stocks. Right now, there is a model, a habitat-based model for Chinook salmon, which gives you a general idea of what productivity should be and what the carrying capacity would be given the watershed size. Now, this was developed in Canada covering some 25 stocks in a particular single analysis. And then with measurement error. First thing you want to do with measurement error is you want to avoid bias in your estimates. We spent a lot of time talking about sample sizes, and that has to deal with variances on the estimates, but far more importantly, the idea of having accurate estimates without bias, is crucial to coming up with a defensible investigation of productivity. As I said before, precision is mostly a matter of sample size, and is generally expressed as a variance. But accuracy is almost entirely due to how samples are taken, how the sampling design was implemented, and what kind of particular method you used for sampling. Most statistical methods for estimation are based on the primary sample being a randomly selected sample. And in almost everything we do, that's not the case. Their samples at best are systematic. You count fish through a weir so many minutes out of every hour, out of so many hours in a day, and you expand. But more likely, our sampling is opportunistic. We take fish in a particular place because that's where we can take them. That we do a carcass survey because we want to estimate the age composition of the escapement, but we take samples from the carcasses because that's our opportunity. Well, I've provided a number of real crude tables of accuracy versus precision for the different methods that we use for estimating spawning abundance. I don't want to go into detail about these, only to say that, as you can imagine, different methods provide different levels of accuracy and different risks involved with coming up with inaccurate or biased estimates. Weirs, towers, sonars, capture, recapture, and surveys, aerial foot and swim surveys. I would point to the capture-recapture studies. We're going to be talking a little more about that when we get into estimating smolt abundance. But as you can imagine, going from weirs to foot surveys, the accuracy that you have essentially declines. Now, it's important that this is recognized so it can be corrected. And a lot of our efforts in Fish and Game have gone into collecting ancillary information such that even though we can end up with a bias, that we can at least correct it or detect it and adjust. Now, besides estimating escapement, you also have to estimate production, and that means estimating catch. And in a terminal fishery, basically the methods we use are fish tickets, permit systems, creel surveys, we've talked about household surveys this morning, and log books. Now, fish tickets and permit systems, I'm assuming in all of this that things are run appropriately, that you didn't have a problem with a technician sleeping in and those sorts of things that do happen, but basically that the method or the gear was correctly applied. Fish tickets and permit systems provide very good accuracy. Creel surveys, household surveys, by creel surveys I mean on-site surveys, they are prone to certain kinds of biases. Now, these biases, when detected, can be corrected, or you can design the study such that you can avoid these biases. For instance, in household surveys, the Statewide Harvest Survey is a good example, and the Statewide Harvest Survey is prone to non-response bias. Basically, that is that if you don't catch fish, you don't respond, and you don't send in that accurate zero. Well, any of you have ever gotten a survey from the Statewide Harvest Survey and then didn't send it in, know what kind of a nag they can be, because they'll just keep sending you these things. And they're not trying to be bothersome. This is the method they use to help correct for non-response bias, because some of the people who don't catch anything will finally respond. And we can use that information to correct our estimates of catch. Now, there's another particular kind of fishery, and we talked about that, Jim, I, and Ellie, and the interception fishery in the high seas. Since we've already talked about adult equivalents and we've already talked about discounting the catches, I won't go on this any longer, except to say that some sort of stock identification is needed in the catches that come in these fisheries. Now, estimating production, step two, well, you know, you just don't estimate production directly. You estimate catch at age, and then you combine it to come up with a production for a brood year. So you have to sample both the escapement and the terminal catch. That's a requirement. And we do so with things like live weirs, carcass weirs, gill nets, seines, fish wheels, carcass surveys, catch sampling, and so on and so forth, where we actually get our hands on fish. Well, this is where the opportunistic sampling is probably at its most dangerous, in that we know that some of these techniques are going to give us essentially a biased sample in and of itself. For instance, carcass weirs have a tendency to collect smaller, younger male Chinook salmon. Carcass surveys, on the other hand, tend to collect older, larger females. So if you were just to take the data, not make a correction, then you're going to end up with a biased sample. Well, so far we've talked just about the basic rudimentary investigation of production. You can get a better understanding of productivity by taking this simple model and taking the process error that's in it and exploding it out into a number of factors. We've heard this morning about sea surface temperatures and Pacific decadal oscillation. We've also heard about ecosystem management. All of these ideas come to reality in looking at these X variables here. Each one of these X variables will correspond to a particular factor. And these factors, when taken together, will explain a fair amount of the process error, or so we hope. Now, this kind of modeling is more complex. It can provide a sufficient understanding of the forces behind productivity, something that is satisfying in terms of getting an answer, or perhaps coming up with a remedy. Now, one difficulty is that the cause and effect of factors is not obvious in this case, in many cases. What is the scientific mechanism between the Pacific decadal oscillation and the return, say, to the Taku River? I mean, what is the particular mechanism? Now, this kind of modeling can work, but it's difficult to apply because you're starting to multiply the effects of not one, but a whole number of observational studies. One way of getting around this multiplication of observational studies is to try to split the life history of Chinook salmon along an obvious line, that is freshwater and saltwater. Now, Dr. Norm will talk about estimating smolt abundance. We do it with cotoar tags here in Alaska, particularly in southeast, and with fairly good success. Now, there are other ways of estimating smolt abundance, weirs, mark recapture, and sonars. Now, the beauty of this is then this allows, if you have this information, to ask questions like we heard this morning, whether or not, you know, what factors in freshwater are driving production. And you don't have all of that marine variation going on that hides, you know, the real factor. Now, in this case, this is the reason that we're wanting to split is because the metric for production, the metric for productivity, is the number of mature fish that come out as progeny in a brood year. Now, you need to have, if you're going to do this kind of modeling, some sort of cause and effect link between the factor you're dealing with and productivity. I present here an example. I call it the hypothetical hypothesis. Nutritional stress from competition has reduced productivity of Chinook salmon. There's just too many animals out there, or too many of one kind of animal, that are essentially causing starvation and death, either directly or indirectly, for Chinook salmon. And the narrative goes something like this: nutritional stress slows body growth while Chinook salmon are at sea. Slower body growth slows the rate of maturation. More time maturing exposes immature fish to more natural mortality, and productivity is therefore lowered. Now, if that hypothesis is true, you should see a couple of things. One is that the average age of returns in a brood year should be inversely related to the abundance of the competitors that you're hypothesizing. And in the same token, if the hypothesis is true, then the body growth of Chinook salmon would also be inversely related to the abundance of competitors. So now we've set up a particular, if you will, observational study to try and confirm, or at least show that it's possible that your hypothetical hypothesis is true. So what you do is you, and I'll just stick here with the idea of body growth, is that you compare the variation in estimates from some index or of the actual abundance of the competitors against variation in the average distance between annuli on scales taken from mature Chinook salmon. Now you have certain consequences looking at these relationships, and you can see those in the panels, the possibilities in the panels at the bottom of the screen. In the case of panel A, you have lots of variation in competition, in the competitors, and you have lots of variation in body growth. The trouble is there's no relationship. Under that scenario, you would reject your hypothesis. Panel B, you've got lots of variation in the abundance of competitors. You don't. In body growth, again, you reject your hypothesis. Now, in the case of the third panel, you've got lots of variation, but the correlation is going the wrong way. It should be negative, which is what you see in panel D. Now, in panel E is real interesting in that essentially you have lots of variation in body growth and very little variation in the number of competitors. Now, in this particular case, I would call no decision because you haven't had enough variation in the competitors to really make a good test. Here's where an observational study is causing you grief. Now, what happens if you throw inaccuracy into this kind of scientific investigation? Let's say you're sampling scales from just escapement or from just catch. And if you do so, you risk a false result when the sampling or management, now this is fisheries management itself, imbues an apparent body growth with false trends. Now this can occur because basically you're interested in the run size of a mature fish and body growth on the mature fish. But a fishery starts to work, and in essence it splits the population up into two pieces. And they don't have to look alike. I mean, gill nets affect the size and age of escapements versus the run size. Also, timing affects the difference between escapement and catch in size at age. Also, you can simply have inaccurate estimates. For instance, say you grab scales from the escapement, but these scales came from a carcass survey. That's going to influence your results. There are a number of ways in which your sampling, if not corrected, will provide biased estimates, which in turn would provide essentially false results, or maybe no results at all. Now, the way to get around this particular problem is what you need to do is reconstruct the run back to what you would expect to see in the mature run that year. What you'd be looking for then is to estimate from the escapement, the body growth, and you estimate from the catch, the body growth. If those two are similar, you can throw everything together and you have a very precise estimate that you can use in your further scientific investigations. If they're different, then it becomes important that you have accurate estimates of catch and accurate estimates of escapement, because those two estimates are going to be used as weights against your two estimates of body growth. In other words, you'll use a weighted average. So even though there are biases, you can correct for them. But if you don't correct for them, then your scientific investigations are going to be perhaps suspect. My final comments. When investigations are based on observational studies, data is always greater than information. That's something you always need to keep in mind. You need to recognize the opportunistic nature of the stock assessment and be able to adjust for it. It's going to happen, so be ready. A lot of the times, well, most of the time, in fact, our philosophy has been to have accurate estimates and essentially correct them if we find bias estimates. But in, also in many cases, what we're using those estimates for is not necessarily what you would be using the data for in a scientific investigation. So it's kind of a caveat for all those who are trying to use data already collected. You need to understand the potential of the methods, the sampling gears, and the fishery management to produce biased estimates, even if these techniques are applied correctly. If inference about productivity of Chinook salmon is to be believed, estimates behind those inferences must be shown to be likely accurate. And this is something very important. It's called documentation. You need to look at the pedigree of the estimates, and they should thoroughly be researched. And if found wanting, the estimation should not be used to investigate productivity. It's better to simply try and find something else. And lastly, if you use those estimates, though, you need to be able to justify them along the lines of the potential biases that you would expect to see from the gear and the methods used. Now, one last slide. This is my illustration of a black swan. A black swan is an unexpected event. And I don't believe the two technicians that were in that boat expected that tree to fall at that particular moment. Now, they didn't expect to go swimming that day. But nothing of what we can do here is going to protect us from black swans. They are, by their very nature, unpredictable. The question was asked today whether or not what we're seeing is a short-term phenomenon with the decline in Chinook stocks, or if we're seeing something that's more long-term. One of the black swans that's probably sitting out there is climate change. So be aware that that sometimes even the best of intentions don't end you up with a good prediction. On that happy note, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. I think we've got time for a couple questions from panelists. And panelists, please identify yourself so folks online know who's who. Randall.
Randall Peterman, Simon Fraser University in British Columbia. Dave, you mentioned on one of your slides the topic of coverage associated with sampling programs. And I know all management agencies face this problem. You've only got so much money to spend going out and gathering data. So there's a trade-off between doing a lot of different sampling at a moderately good level over a large number of stocks versus doing a really good job of sampling on a few stock or subpopulations or areas, whatever units you want to use. Could you tell us a little bit about how ADF&G has made that trade-off decision?
Well, when I've been around and we've made that decision, it's been really down on the much lower level. I mean, we don't have a policy along these lines. But if we're starting out in a situation in which we are very ignorant of what to expect, we try and spread our sampling out in, you know, very widely and very shallowly. And the idea being that not only may we hit it on the mark, but if we don't, we'll at least have the information to do a better job next time. And that we get some idea of the variation that we're seeing to see whether or not we need to concentrate in one particular area or in a particular, or another. And then sometimes, if we just simply don't have enough resources to give us the coverage we need, we'll try and do something else completely. The coverage I was talking about in the slide had to do more with sonars, I believe. And in that case, sonars, I mean, the beam covers a certain percentage of the water column. And anything that it doesn't cover, any fish that go by, of course, aren't counted. So,
Milo, and then Jim.
Milo Atkinson, University of Alaska. So, I'm hoping this comes out as a question, not as a comment. But forecasts of returns are generally awful. And for the majority of the salmon stocks in the state, it's hard to have a defensible stock recruitment relationship and an escapement goal based on that. So I was wondering if you could, and oftentimes it's just hideously expensive, or it might take forever to get to the point where you can do that. I was wondering if you could maybe spend a minute and talk about like the escapement goal policy and the ways that you use robust management to deal with these problems that are caused by uncertainty.
The Alaska's escapement goal policy is extremely robust to errors as far as what the goal would be. By that, I don't mean to say that it's going to be optimal escapement. I mean it's robust in that it will provide escapement. If you make errors in determining what it would be, then the errors generally do not fall to the stock. We had a situation back 20 years ago, 25 years ago, where we had a whole series of escapements in southeast and down south, where we had very little information, and basically what, particularly the Canadians, what they did is they took the highest escapement goal, the highest escapement they had seen in a aerial survey or foot survey, and doubled it. We've since learned that the exploitation was not that heavy to begin with, and basically we started setting escapement goals pretty close to carrying capacity. Well, that raised havoc with the fisheries, as you can imagine, but sure it didn't hurt the stocks. So the escapement goal policy is very robust in that fashion. Now, is that what you're trying to get at? Or
yeah, I guess I'm trying to get at you've listed a whole bunch of ways that the data you can collect can be less than perfect, and sometimes it's pretty expensive and maybe not worth it to get to the point where you've got data that gives you ideal management. And so I know Fish and Game spends a lot of time thinking of ways to manage appropriately in those situations.
I am a real fan of something I'm not very good at, and that's Bayesian analysis. We've started moving towards, state-space models within a Bayesian context, and it captures a lot of the uncertainty that you see in your data. It doesn't protect you against black swans so much, but it essentially is a good comprehensive way to express your escapement goal in a way that so you can have some idea of the risk involved in making an error. And so that even makes it more, robust. You hear a lot these days about precautionary management. And I was always kind of mystified in that I always thought the escapement goals, for instance, were a good example of precautionary management. And that goes all the way back to W.F. Thompson. So in some respects, fisheries management is not new to the precautionary management arena. So I like escapement goals for that reason. Now they have other problems, but we'll probably talk about that later.